The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And hello, everybody. Welcome to the Sunday Space Show. Great to be here on a rainy day in the San Francisco Bay Area. I hope wherever you are that you're having great weather and you're doing really well and enjoying all of the benefits that one can enjoy. Let's go through the announcements and then start talking with our guest. The toll-free number for those of you who want to use it rather than email or chat is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, there are no call screeners. And don't forget also that you're brought up immediately onto the line, but you may be put on hold. And just be patient. There's one line, and we'll bring you into the show as soon as possible. And in addition, I don't have any problem holding you over a break. So call away, 1-866-687-7223. Email is drspace@thespaceshow.com, thespaceshow@gmail.com, and dmlivings@yahoo.com. And chat is IMICQ or CompuServe. The screen name is the same for all three services, one word, lowercase, space, show, chat. And that screen name should be visible now. If it's not visible, here's what you do. You face east, you do 25 jumping jacks, and you yell, "We love space," and I promise you it'll be back up by that time. But it does help, by the way, if you send me a little note telling me that you're going through the ritual to get Space Show Chat back up and visible. Remember that we're trademarked and copyrighted, but you do have permission to copy shows, download them, share them, pass them around. The only restrictions are nothing commercial. And please don't modify or change the text of any of the interviews. We do podcast. Gigadial.net is our major podcasting client. The RSS is on our website and both of our newsletters, but we're carried in iTunes, Podcast Alley, Astrospace Now in South America, and a host of other places across North America and elsewhere. You can easily find our podcast. If you have any questions, just send me an email, and I'll be glad to help you. In iTunes, please search for for the Space Show or my name. And the RSS subscription URL is in our newsletter, both of them, the little short one that comes out by email and the big one that is on the website. And you'll find it on our website as well. Easy to subscribe to. If you have any questions, go ahead and fire me an email at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And that is our website, thespaceshow.com. Remember, our comprehensive newsletter is uploaded Sunday evening or early Monday morning, California time at the latest. It has all of the details of the program. And in addition to having all of those details, it has a future events section, and this is the only place you'll find the future events section. It is not on the email newsletter. So if you want to know what's in store for us, then go ahead and check out that website newsletter. You can't miss it. It also has the guest search tool. You'll see it on the website. If you click on that, you can easily do a global search to find out if your favorite person has been on the show and when that person was on the show. And then you go back to the website and scroll all the way down and plug in that date, and you'll find that show. I wish it were more interactive. It will be when we are able to properly fund and design our new website. But for now, at least you can track all of our guests and see if your favorite person has been on the show and when. You'll see a store on our website. It says Space Show Gear. Check it out. And then, of course, the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with one giant leap foundation. We absolutely need your support. We cannot do this show without your support. And we thank all of you who have supported us in the past and who will be supporting us in the future. Get more information about One Giant Leap at www.onegiantleapfoundation.org. Both there and on the Space Show site are PayPal links for contributions. Remember, if you're a U.S. taxpayer, you do get a tax donation for contributing to One Giant Leap Foundation and the Space Show. Please remember, we do Twitter, MySpace, and Facebook to promote the show. And also, the Space Show is brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, promoting cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, visit secureworldfoundation.org. And a couple of hold the dates because they are coming up fast. In fact, I can't believe how fast they're coming up. Responsive Space is, I think, 2 weeks, March 8th through the 11th. Westin Hotel in Los Angeles, responsivespace.org. I'm planning to be there, so if any of you want to meet face-to-face, come on over to the Westin Hotel, register for Responsive Space. I do a live show. It's the only place I do a live show from, and that will be Tuesday evening. And you're welcome to come in and join us for that live show. You can even be on the program because the only people speaking on that program are people from Responsive Space. Space Access Society is April 8th through the 10th in Phoenix, Arizona, and their website, space-access.org. The Contact Conference, March 26th through the 28th at NASA Ames. Their website, contact-conference.com. National Space Symposium by the Space Foundation, Colorado Springs, April 12th through the 15th. And their website is spacefoundation.org. And again, there's usually between 6,000 and 8,000 people that attend this. And Colorado Springs is one really, really cool place to be. But I'm telling you, if you don't have your reservations now, I don't know if you could even get a reservation at a hotel or motel at this point. I mean, that town really fills up for this symposium. So if you're thinking about doing it, act on that really quickly because it's going to slip away from you. ISDC and the Space Investment Summit. So we start off with the Space Investment Summit Wednesday, May 26th. It is at the Intercontinental Chicago Hotel at O'Hare Airport. And their website is spaceinvestmentsummit.com. And then immediately after that, May 27th through the 31st, is ISDC 2010, same hotel. And the best way to get to their website is nss.org, and then look for the ISDC link. And that's it for hold the dates for right now. We'll start adding some more in a little while. So it is really a pleasure, as always, to bring back my former UND student, but someone who has gone way, way beyond being a student at UND, and that's Matt Allner. His full bio is going to be up on the website, but some highlights. He works for Search and Rescue. He has a BS in biology, minor in psychology. His MS in space studies at UND was finished in May of last year, and he did a really cool thesis of a compilation of original research studies regarding human factors and social psychology, group dynamics in extreme environments for the long-duration space flight. He's been a school teacher in lots of different states. We're going to talk about this. He applied to be an astronaut, and he's been interviewed in that process. He can tell us what it's like to be an astronaut or to at least be considered to be an astronaut. And, well, let's just start talking to Matt instead of my reading about him. Quite an accomplished young man. Matt, welcome back. How are you?
I'm great, David. Thanks again for having me back on the show.
How do you find time to do things? I mean, you're so involved and you've been doing so many different projects and you're on search and rescue and you've got a couple of kids and a great wife. I mean, how do you make time for being a space cadet?
Well, I always joke around with my wife, and I always tell her I'll sleep when I'm dead. So I have to sometimes kind of juggle and sacrifice my sleep patterns and whatnot. But, you know, I have a real supportive family. I spend a lot of time at home with them, and I just make sure that the time when I'm home, I make it as quality as I can. But, you know, it's just, you know, you prioritize. there's definitely a lot busier people in the world that I've met that juggle a lot more than I do. So every time I think I have it pretty rough and I'm juggling a lot, there's people that are showing me that you can still, you know, find a way to juggle more. So just a day at a time.
Okay, so Matt, let's boy, so much to start out with. Let's start out with education, okay?
Okay.
Millions of parents in this country, let's just stick to this country, okay, to the United States, trust their little darlings to the public school system primarily, although many trust their little darlings to the private school system or religious school, but for the most part the private school system, and to teachers who, at least from my perspective, focus on getting a teacher's credential. And I can tell you teacher stories up the wazoo that my friend tells me about what goes on in my area. And it is a really high-end, upper-end public educational school district, one of the tops in California, although that doesn't mean much anymore. And, I mean, when they ask questions like, what's the capital of Scandinavia? And a father comes in with the kid's spelling list and says, you've got words on here that aren't real words. And the teacher gets offended and complains to the principal. And they tell the father that if he has any more complaints, to go directly to the principal. And neither principal nor the teacher address the fact that there's phony words on the spelling list for, I guess it was a second or a third grader. And the list goes on and on. But we're trusting our little darlings to this system and to these teachers. And you are a teacher, and something is really, really wrong, Matt, not just about space and STEM and science, but it's really, really wrong. You know, I told the story on the show about being at UND and mentioning to Vadim, who you know, Solzhenitsyn's name, and nobody at the table knew who he was except for those of us that were over 50 years old. None of the graduate students who were there knew who he was. And something is wrong. So now you have the microphone. What's wrong? Where do the problems start? How does it get fixed, or does it get fixed?
Well, you know, it's a big question, and you know, you ask a lot of questions within what you're asking. And I guess the first thing I want to say to everybody out there is just to stop a minute and relax. We get so worked up and bent out of shape about a story or a little thing we hear there. I don't think society's ever been perfect, at least from what the history I know of it. It's been pretty chaotic ever since the beginning of time. And, you know, one of the things we got to understand with education is it's always going to be ongoing and it's always going to be evolving. And it's in a state of change. And I guess as an educator, but more so as a parent, the biggest concern I have is that we tend to, in the United States, you know, and I'm young, I'm 35, I've been teaching only 13 years, so I'm not going to speak like, you know, I know all the answers, but from what I've seen and what I know, we tend to change things for the sake of changing things instead of changing them sometimes for the right reasons. And I think a lot of good education has been removed. You know, I think back to some of the great teachers I had. I was very blessed. You know, I had some teachers that maybe weren't as great as others, but it didn't make them bad teachers. You know, if you don't have those experiences as a person growing up and every experience you have is perfect, you never really learn how to grow, you know, because you live in utopia and that's not the reality of things. So I think going back to, you know, my experience as a child and growing up in school and having, you know, teachers that that I really, you know, related well to and enjoyed, every teacher I had brought something great to the table. They were good at what they did. They understood it. Now, whether they articulated it to students in, you know, better or worse ways, that, you know, that depended on the teacher. But so many things that I learned in school, I've integrated those into my teaching style and my philosophy, and I've carried those in the classroom with my students, and I've seen success. And I know it wasn't something that they invented. It was something that, you know, they were exposed to, and they passed on to us in the classroom. And a lot of these strategies are being considered non-useful, or they're failing our students. And instead of trying to shape, kind of balance shaping new teaching strategies to the new student we're teaching, but also shaping the student to the strategies we know that have worked, we're kind of in a state now where we're like, well, throw out the old, and we need to reinvent the wheel and start everything over. And I just personally don't agree with that. I think there's an integration. I always like to use the term the new old school. You know, you keep the good things from the past and you don't let them go. That's kind of your traditional basis. But you also don't hold on to the past so much that you're not willing to make change and bring in new ideas and incorporate them into what you have as your core. So there's kind of that balance that I feel has made me successful as a teacher. And I just see so many young teachers coming in that have just, they haven't even been given that chance to keep those old things. They've just been just flooded with all these new and multitude of strategies. And I just see them not getting where they need to get. And so, you know, I guess in a nutshell, I don't see where our education system is that broken. Everybody else does. And I guess the thing I would point the public to is if our system is so broken, why do international, you know, why do other countries still send their best and brightest to our country to learn and go to school in our institutions and not just college? I mean, from the secondary levels on up. And part of you has to kind of be open to that, you know, maybe it isn't as bad as we think. Maybe it's just not what it used to be, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's ruined and it's bad. But there's a lot of changes going on. I will agree that there's, you know, there are some things that do have to get fixed and changed. But I guess I just ask everyone just to kind of take a deep breath, slow down, count to 10, and look at the big picture and look at the good quality things that are still happening. Because the minute we start to think that our education system is in the trash, it's in the tank, psychologically we're spreading a message across our country and we're dooming something that is still very good and it's still very strong. So
I don't know. I mean, when my kids were in public school, it could not compare to what I did in the 50s in Tulsa. With science and history and what we had to read. And they had all these politically oriented forced assemblies that took out class time that we never had to do anything like that in the 50s. I mean, that stuff wasn't invented, you know, back then. My kids had really bad politically correct textbooks and, you know, I tried to go in and be a guest lecturer on the commercial space chapter and on genetics in integrated science, which is another wonder class that they put into our system rather than, you know, the old traditional science classes. But once the UC system accepted integrated science, then that's the way everything started to go. And the teacher told me, no time for guest teachers. We have to teach to the tests that are coming up. And in fact, there's a question sitting here for you from Bob in San Diego that says, what is your response when you're told by your teachers and your school administration that they don't have time for certain kinds of curriculum because they have to teach to the test that they're required by state and federal law to take? So, you know, Bob is actually asking you that question. And I encountered that as a parent. You know, in school is very, very frustrating and, you know, you pick your battles carefully, right?
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, one person isn't going to go up and challenge or win against the school board unless you're in Kansas and you're talking about evolution or something.
Well, yeah. I say first of all, it's a great question. And I think, was it Bob? Is that correct?
Yeah, Bob in San Diego.
First of all, Bob, if you're listening, I used to live out in San Diego. That was my initial stomping grounds when I moved from Iowa. I lived in PV, was kind of a surf bum for the summer and was looking for a teaching job. And eventually did land a teaching job up in Ventura and taught there for 5 years. So I'm pretty familiar with the California education system. It's where I got my start teaching and really had a lot of fun. But your question is the number one question. And ironically, California and Texas were both kind of ahead of the curve. They're, you know, two of the bigger states as far as student population. So they would always start things about 2 to 3 years ahead of the curve if they knew things politically were coming down the road. And so, you know, No Child Left Behind, state standardized testing being more of a focus and how the kids were performing on that particular test. I think it was the STAR test when I was out there teaching. I believe it still is. Those were big things. And they, about the third year I was teaching out there, they became a huge thing. That was when Governor Gray Davis took office. He initiated kind of a more simple version of today's pay-for-performance plan, which hopefully I'll get a chance to talk a little bit about here today. And it was encouraging schools to work together as a school to, you know, raise the level of achievement. And in the state of California, they did, teachers did really well. And if I remember correctly from the facts of what happened, schools had performed so well that the budget surplus that had been put aside for schools that hit their goal and received the compensation, balanced. I mean, it zeroed out the checking account within a year, half or 2 years of the first 2 years that they ran it. And they didn't anticipate it to be so successful. So I kind of saw where, you know, here comes the era of how important this test is going to become. And the reality is a test is only a snapshot. You know, if you just took one test in a semester in college and that was all you took and that was the grade you got, I mean, that wouldn't put into place anything that you'd done day in and day out. And, you know, the thing I always say to people is, you know, what if you had your absolutely worst day of your life the day before the day of the test that you sat down to take? That doesn't factor in, and they don't consider those kind of things, the emotional pieces. And you know, a lot of the children that we teach, and I teach in a very at-risk district, and so now in Colorado, and a lot of our students come to the table with some difficulties. They have challenges, and some more than the normal, some, you know, just like everybody else. But, you know, on a given day, they may have a really bad day, and they may have other more important, and in my opinion, definitely more important issues that are pressing. And I think we can all remember back to school at some point when we had a really bad day and we went to school and our mind just wasn't there. And some of the kids that are going to school are experiencing that 3 to 4 days out of the week. And, you know, we can't give them an excuse not to learn, and that's not what I'm saying. But there's some empathy and there's a human side to working with people, especially children, that I think is missing when we put so much emphasis and focus on a test. And, you know, every state is doing things differently as far as how they focus on their tests. I know when I was teaching in Iowa has a great education system, and that's where I went to school. Their emphasis on the state test was not very high. I mean, obviously, you know, you didn't want your kids to do poorly, but it wasn't like, you know, you went home and had a ton of work stress because your kids didn't perform on the test. But that's not the case anymore. The stress is really high. And the anxiety leading up to the state test in Colorado, at least, and then the months after until the reports come back and you see how your kids did, it's very intense. It's very intense, and it's intense with different people, especially building principals. So, as a teacher, I don't want to, you know, buck the system by saying that the test is not important, but it's just a snapshot. And there's other things that I think parents need to be watching more carefully. If they're involved in the school and the district, they should know the curriculum being taught. If you don't like it or approve it, you get involved. You go to your board meetings. You speak up when you have an opportunity. You get to know your board members. That's a huge piece, is getting to know the board. I mean, the board in every district has the power to change things. And, you know, they hire the superintendent, they fire the superintendent. The board is so important. So who you elect and then how you get involved and get to know them and share with them your concerns, but be diplomatic about how you do it. It's a really critical piece. And I don't think that a lot of people go that route. They go to the principal, they go to the superintendent, and they want the change to happen there. But in reality, the strongest change comes from the board, and then it gets passed down. So, you know, there's a lot of things that I hope will happen down the road. I don't think state tests should be removed, but it should just be a tool and an assessment tool to let parents know how kids are doing. And, you know, as a parent myself, I don't get too worked up on how my children do on the state test. Obviously, I want them to do well, and if I see they're struggling in an area, then we get more involved as parents. But I think that's the best thing parents can do, is to get involved, but get involved the right way and be supportive of the system, and be supportive of your teachers, and give them the benefit of the doubt, and try to work with them. Because at the end of the day, the success of the child comes from three people ideally working together, and that's the parent, the teacher, and the student. And if those three pieces aren't working together collaboratively, then you're going to have problems. So,
It sounds almost like write a letter to your congressman, you know. a couple of things. Number one, a lot of the class time is spent with students teaching, you know, being taught for the state and the federal government test. And it's not being taught on curriculum. Yeah, you can get involved with curriculum and even textbook selection, and it's a real strenuous, time-consuming process. Number two, you will encounter, I guarantee you, really, really, really dumb teachers, like the one who's asking for the capital of Scandinavia or makes up words and doesn't know that they're not real words on a spelling test, or worse and worse, and, you know, things like that. And when the parent encounters that and has no place to go because the teacher has tenure but really and truly should not be teaching kids because they're really dumb, that's a very frustrating process to go through. So I guess we could do the whole show on that and not come up with a solution. I'm aware of that. But I want to eventually get to STEM and where do you start, and can you carve out a special curriculum for space? But let me ask you Rita's question, which I read to you before the show started, which is basically, you know, what is wrong with our California schools, and can you compare them to other states, specifically the states you've taught in, Colorado and Iowa, and is there a really big difference, or do we just hear that California is so much worse?
Well, that's a good question, and actually, that was actually a question I had as I went through my teaching career. You know, I taught my first 5 years in California, but I had done my student teaching and then all my formal schooling, including college, in Iowa, so I was pretty familiar with the education system in Iowa. And, you know, I always felt, because my dad was a teacher, he taught math in the middle schools for 35 years, and he was an amazing teacher. I always felt and knew that Iowa's education system was strong. And, you know, I come from a family of educators and military primarily, and, you know, our standards are high, both academically and sports and everything else. But, you know, getting into your question on the difference between the states, when I moved to Iowa to teach, the first thing that happened was my class sizes went down. I had 35 students in a class. I had five or six classes a day. So I had on the order of about 180 kids a day that I saw when I was in California, and it was a heavy plate. And when I moved to Iowa, I taught in a farming community at a high school, and my biggest class size was 12. My smallest class size was 6.
Yeah, but you're in a much smaller population area. Is that even a fair comparison?
Well, no, but the point I'm getting at is that my quality of teaching and being able to really help kids exponentially changed. I mean, the magic I was able to work and working with a child that had problems behaviorally, cooperating and learning how to integrate themselves into a regular classroom, because the reality today is that kids are not being they're being put in the regular classroom, whether they have behavioral problems or not. In our district, they're expected to be in the regular classroom unless they're so dysfunctional they're on a plan that removes them, but very few students are in that situation. So it allowed you the ability to really help that child, because you maybe only had one, maybe two kids that were acting that way, as opposed to 6 or 7. And I tell you, a lot of the behavioral issues that teachers are faced against does not allow them much time to plan and prepare for quality instruction. You could spend your whole planning period on the phone calling parents and then hoping that they'll support you and help you at home, so when the kid comes back the next day, they're there to learn, as opposed to there to just intentionally disrupt. And those are things I've seen really change over time, is the student's willingness to come to class to learn, as opposed to, a kid sitting there refusing to learn but not causing problems is one thing, but a student sitting there refusing to learn and disrupting the whole classroom so they can't learn is another. And it sounds simple, we'll just remove the student, but in reality it doesn't work that way anymore in education. I mean, there's a huge process in place before a student can be removed that might be disrupting a whole class, and everything has to happen for several weeks and months before that student could be removed from the environment and causing problems. So, and, you know, when I was in Iowa, again, the numbers were lower, so you're able to better manage those kind of things and get them turned around working for you as a teacher, so you could get back to really, you know, teaching your whole class. Moving here to Colorado Springs, you know, back to a little bit bigger class sizes, not as high as 35, but, you know, we average anywhere between, I'd say, 20 and 26, maybe 27 in a classroom. And, you know, again, you know, those issues become more of an impact during the day when you're trying to work. And I think, you know, it depends on the district you're in, but if you're under a lot more pressure for your students to perform because you're at a, you know, a lower performing school, then, you know, having time to really focus on the quality instruction as opposed to managing all the behaviors, those things become critical pieces. So, you know, I had a great experience teaching in California. That's where I got my start and really my love for teaching space. It came from there with being so close to JPL. I was fortunate when I went to Iowa, of all places, which has hardly any aerospace industry, like North Dakota, I was fortunate enough that there was a NASA presence in my hometown and was able to really bring in some great things. So, you know, every state's offered something different, but the beauty of teaching has been, for me, has been utilizing the resources in the communities where I've lived, and some have been, there's been more resources than others, but it's been utilizing those resources and making those community contacts and partners and pulling people in from the real world to help shape your teaching so that it's giving kids the curriculum that they're supposed to be getting, but also how it ties to the real world and how it could be applicable when they get into the working world. So
essentially you're doing in situ resource utilization.
Exactly. Surviving on Mars.
Your classroom is the analog model for space development.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like
Matt, what is the age appropriate level to start, you know, probably a decent STEM education, and can you put something about space into that, or do you have to wait, you know, for the kid to get a lot older? I mean, how do you start to integrate STEM and space into a public education?
Well, I think there's a lot of great efforts that I see going on right now with STEM. Of course, it's a hot topic, and how do we get kids more involved and more engaged in science? You know, I was just, I've been reading a little bit about NASA's plans or fact sheet. I think it was a 4-page sheet that was on the web. The very last paragraph there on page 4 talks about inspiring more young people to engage in STEM. It's the number one question. You know, kids aren't that interested in it because it's hard. They have to work. They have to think. You know, it's not the video game doing all the creativity for them. They have to generate it from the basic tools they have. You know, I just think back to growing up as a kid. You know, we would play in the backyard. We didn't have fake guns or swords and knives and things like that, but we grabbed a stick and we broke it into pieces so that it looked like a gun and it had a handle, or it looked like a sword, or whatever we needed it to become. And sometimes it was a multi-use stick, and it could turn into different, you know, weapons if you were playing army or whatever you're doing. You know, the creativity that I remember having as a boy, I just don't see enough kids doing that. You know, I remember riding my bike everywhere around the neighborhood. You know, mom and dad weren't getting us in the car and taking us places. If we wanted to go, we got on our bike or we walked. But it was a little safer world than it is today, too. So, you know, putting that into perspective. But kids just are growing up different, and so obviously the way they're thinking and the way they process things is differently. But, you know, going back again to students in school, and we're all concerned about their performance, I always kind of joke around. I always try to be a little lighthearted about things and, you know, keep my optimism open. But I'll always joke around with people and say, well, you know, we're all worried about our kids not passing the state test, but do you think they're really not learning? And people kind of look at me and say, well, what do you mean by that? I'm like, well, these kids are smart. I said, you got a cell phone in your pocket, and they pull it out. I'm like, is there things you don't know how to do on that? I said, hand it to a middle school student, and in 3 minutes they'll give you a tutorial without even reading the manual, and they probably don't even own that phone. They can tell you how to use it. That takes intelligence. And how do kids learn how to do that? From getting their hands on things, and they're not afraid to play around with it, and they learn it quick. They're learning plenty, and they're probably learning more than we ever learned at their age. They're just learning different stuff because of what's around and what they're surrounded with. So it's kind of funny where we're still concerned about our kids not learning, and, yeah, they might not be learning the things we need them to learn, but they're learning, and they're learning a lot, and they're a lot more street smart than we ever were. They are more aware, and, of course, they have a lot, in my opinion, a lot more pressures at younger ages than we ever had to deal with. And, of course, that depends on where you grew up, big city or small town, but their level of of peer pressure is so much higher. I mean, they have a lot more on their plate, and I'm trying to come from the point of view of the teacher of trying to better understand my student as opposed to better understanding how to get them to perform on a test, because I think that we have not paid well enough attention to children. We haven't really looked at what their needs are and really addressed them. I think we've maybe acknowledged what their needs are, but we really haven't taken care of their needs. And I think there's a really big piece missing in children's lives, that their needs are not being met. We're not filtering. We're not protecting. We're not doing enough of the things to allow them to be in an environment that's conducive to learning. So.
Well, how do you get them to do more STEM classes or more STEM education? Yeah, it's hard.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you hand me an iPhone, I think that that's really hard to figure out how to work it.
Not a middle schooler, man. They'll take that thing and they'll have it programmed and have iPads.
Well, so maybe, you know, the iPhone is subterfuge and it teaches them STEM education. I don't know. But how do you get them to take the classes and to do the hard work to go on? I mean, and what percentage of students from your experience do elect to take a STEM sort of path in school versus, you know, home ec or something like that?
Well, that's a great question. I think the first part of that answer is that you got to find something that's interesting to kids. And, you know, from being on past shows and, of course, you know, from doing this, my work as a rescue diver and as a recreational diver, you know, I pulled some scuba in. You know, kids were jazzed when they heard about that. You know, they all wanted to be signed up. Unfortunately, I could only take, I think it was 14 kids into the first cohort group because I only had equipment for 14 kids. But they ate it up. I mean, they were doing fractions. They were learning dive tables. We eventually got 4 sixth graders certified right before. This is before I moved to Colorado. And, I mean, the stuff that they were having to do in sixth grade, I had learned like 4 years prior. You know, I was 32. So, you know, they got engaged. And they started better understanding fractions and you know, the concept of formulas. They started understanding how it applied to things that were really critical. And in diving, obviously, you got to pay attention. I mean, this is serious stuff. You know, you go down to, you know, 60 feet. And, you know, you do a rapid, you know, rapid surface because you're out of air. You know, you got to understand physiologically and mathematically what's going on in the body as you're shooting to the top in a panic. And you teach that to students, and they start to understand the fractions and dive time and, what you know, going to 60 feet versus 90 feet versus 30 feet and what that does to the air in your tank and pressure. It just, it takes on a whole new meaning, but it's applicable. It's not just a story on a piece of paper. It is a story on a piece of paper, but pretty soon it's going to be a story when they're in the water. And so they pay more attention to it. And I think those kind of things, and there's lots of teachers doing that kind of stuff, are the key to getting kids involved. You got to expose them to things where financially they may not have an opportunity to. And, you know, that's where you get out in your community, you make your partners, and you get places like your Walmarts and your Home Depots or whoever it is that you need around you to donate. And those places are willing to help if they see you're doing those kind of things. So I think having those things in place will get kids involved in STEM. And from there, the kids naturally get more interested in math and science. And at least I've seen that in my teaching experience. So.
Yeah, I have a question I'm going to ask you in just a minute from a listener. But for the end of last year, I did a show through the National Biomedical Research Institute in Houston with two of their leading radiation and bone loss researchers who at the time were at Clemson. They may have moved to another university. I'm not sure. It was either them or it was on an engineering show I did on how to land large payloads on Mars. So I don't really remember which one of these two shows brought this up, but somehow I was joking around and I said, well, you know, if that's such a hard problem, why don't you just give it to one of your students on an iPhone and let them play around with it? And he said, oh, we do that. And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, there are a lot of Martian algorithms for an iPhone where you can land large payloads and navigate and do all sorts of things on Mars. And you can download these apps. And we use them a lot. And people at NASA use them a lot because they're pretty accurate and they're quick and dirty. And, you know, most of these people can work an iPhone, you know, like I know how to tie my shoes, okay? So, you know, the real thing is, I mean, you could... I know Apple gives away, you know, the Mac computers to a lot of schools. to you. But if they had these iPhones or whatever, the other one is, it's not the telephone but has all the apps. Oh, what the hell is it called? I think it's the big iPod, where you have all the apps but not the telephone. I mean, the truth is, if you got a kid engaged in, you know, playing SimCity to go to Mars and designing a mission to go to Mars and land the damn thing on Mars with a real, you know, NASA competent, almost quality program for real, I mean, that kid is going to have an awful lot about math and engineering to do that, that is built into that, you know, iPhone application. And they learn how to do it. So maybe the key in today's world is beyond a textbook. Maybe the key is to be competitive with the computer games and the video games and the iPods and all the things that are out there for kids, and have these real life things on there that teach them how to do it, but also let them know that they just, you know, designed a mission to go to Mars.
Yeah, I think you hit on a good topic. You know, I've actually gone back and forth between the balance of technology. Again, that the term I used at the beginning of the show, the new old school. You know, I always joke around and say, I'm the new old school. I like to be that combination of both. My dad was a math teacher for 35 years, and so obviously math was something that we had to be good at in the home, and if we struggled, we had a tutor every night. Although we didn't necessarily like our dad tutoring us, because you know how fathers are with their kids, and especially sons, you know, they're pretty tough on them when it comes to making sure they do everything just right. You know, if we did our homework flop and we were done, we had to rewrite it. So it's kind of funny growing up at home with that. But it taught us to do things right the first time and not to take a short course. And one of the things that I saw when I started teaching was, you know, technology started becoming a big deal. I piloted a few technology programs for the state of California when I was out there. The big one, if I remember, it was kind of a hot one, was the laptop cart, where you have a laptop cart that has wireless capabilities, and all your kids have, you know, a laptop in the classroom. You can take it out, you know, outside the school within range of your cart and still have access to internet out in the field. And you know, there's a lot of technology being pushed in math classes right now. But what's really interesting is when I get around to these rooms and I see the kids working with all this technology, they can't explain the basic core of what it is that they're doing. Now, they're engaged and they're very active and they're looking like they're busy and learning, and they are, but they're trying to figure things out because a lot of the kids don't have a core. And that comes from the old school, get your nose in the textbook, learn your math facts, get your times tables down. And a lot of kids don't have that. And so, to me, there's a fine balance. You know, with our kids in school, the minute I see them, you know, doing all this technology in, for instance, a math class, but they've forgotten their basic math skills, is the day I pull that away from them as a parent. Because if they don't know those basic skills, it doesn't matter if they have an iPhone and they can do all these applications. If they don't know the basic core of math, they're not going to get anywhere. And they're going to just be plugging in answers they hope are right and doing tons of miscalculations. So there's kind of an integration taking place with technology, where we've got to properly manage it, and we've got to understand, I think, especially in education, what its limits are and how it best can be used, to just all of a sudden, you know, flood a classroom with tons of technology because this is the way things should be today in our world, is not the right thing to do if the students don't have a basic core. It's kind of like GPS. I always joke around with GPS. I teach it to my students. You know, we have Garmin's in my room before they even get...
Whoa. You have GPS in your classroom?
Oh, yeah. I have Garmin's. We go out in the field. I teach them caching and all sorts of
things. And do you furnish this, or your school district furnished this?
This came from the NASA grant that we're involved with about 2 years ago. I purchased these to teach the kids, you know, to integrate the technology. But what I do, trying to show my district that, you know, to just throw technology in the classroom without giving a core, I mean, I try to model what I believe in, is they have to learn how to read a map and use a regular map and compass first. And what I teach the kids is, hey, when I'm up at Pike Peak or I'm up in the mountains doing my mountaineering work, if my GPS takes a crap on me, or my batteries die, or my backup batteries, you know, I didn't replace them, I mean, there's a million scenarios that could make that GPS quit working for you. If I don't have a backup plan, a map and a compass, or even worse, if I lose those things, say I lose my backpack in the middle of a climb or have to cut it loose to lessen my weight, do I still have the basic core skills? Can I use shadows? Can I go back to the old school using the sun and the sundial techniques for navigation? Do I have those skills? And for me, as a mountaineer, if I don't have those basics, I am not going to put my life in the hands of a piece of technology that was built by a person that I know at some point will have a chance of failing. So I think the most fail-safe way you can go is to have that core, have that survival skill training, so to speak, or those math facts accomplished and memorized. So if you need to go back to them, you can, and you know how to use them when and all else your technology might fail. So, again, that's just, it's my philosophy, and I'm not expecting anyone else to necessarily agree with me. But in the work I do in extreme environments, you've got to have basic skills, but you've also got to understand the technology you have, but understand its limitations.
I need to bring in John's question, but somebody ought to go sit down with Stephen Jobs and the Apple folks, and instead of logging into your iPhone or iPod with a password or your cell phone number, you have to pass some kind of a high-end, short, multi-faceted question test on the basic rules of your application. So you want to land a payload on Mars. You get an engineering test or something in order to log on to
it. Right?
You know, you got to do the rocket equation perfect or something like that. But let me give you John's question, because I'm delaying on this. This is from Dr. Jurist, who I believe you know, who's also an adjunct at UND. Your discussion sequels in the loss of manual skills with kids. The previous generation used to play with erector sets, electronic kits, tinker toys with cars, etc. Relatively few grade school children can solder wire, build a model airplane other than snap it together, or other basic abilities. A big exception to this observation comes from farm and ranch kids. And yeah, we had shop, and you know, we did all of that, an electric shop, and you know, we made things out of metal and woods. And you know, my kids growing up, they didn't even have a shop class. Wasn't even taught anymore. So they don't, you know, learn how to build or anything like that. So your comments?
Great question. The first time I saw the answer to that question, or a part of it, was when I was teaching and moved back to Iowa. I was in a farming community, and, you know, I had a love for NASA science, so I integrated into a couple of pieces of things we were doing. We learned some geology, so I was teaching them a little bit about Mars geology and endolith and hypolith, and, of course, these farm kids are like, endo what? And what was really funny, though, was it really stirred things up in a negative way. Because parents were wanting to know why their kids were having, you know, learning this, and all I was trying to do was apply it to a space application, because I saw these kids were very smart. I mean, they were very hands-on, very good at tinkering and just building things to make things work, like you said, like an erector set, but they were doing real stuff on the farms with machinery and tools. And what I found I had to do with them was I had to tie it into farming. And, of course, with agriculture, that's an easy one because, you know, you can't move to Mars without having agriculture, understanding plants, and, of course, then you got the low-pressure environment and everything else. So then I started kind of teaching them about that, and I started talking to them a little bit about satellites and GPS, and I said, you know, how many of your families have combines that use GPS for your field plotting and your crop analysis? And a couple kids in class did, and they were kind of my problem students at the time. And I saw the wheels turning, and the next day they came in to class, and they had so much stuff they brought from home. They said, you know, you were talking about satellites and GPS and stuff yesterday, and it was at that point that I won these kids over, and I won so many of my classes over, and I won the families over with being more open to accepting the NASA and the space science. But it just took, you know, relating it to something that they love to do. Now, going into the second part of that answer, I think with, you know, kids, and I think kids are so used to us just giving them step by steps on how to build things and do things, they don't know how to think through a problem. So one of the things in the last 3 years I've been doing as a teacher is, especially with the space science and STEM, is I do these what are called engineering design challenges, and I got the idea from, you know, working in some of NASA's programs. But what I'll do is I'll give kids things that they can find around the house, paper, paper clips, pens, pencils, different types, you know, newspaper foil, aluminum foil, all sorts of things. And I'll give them a challenge. I'll say, okay, you have to build this, and it doesn't have to look like anything other than what you build it to look like, but this is all you have to work with. You have a weight requirement, you have a size requirement. What you build has to fit inside this little box, and it has to fit. It can't stick out. It can't weigh more than so many grams. And it's got to do these things. And, you know, we may be building a parachute. I'm going to have some of my 6th and 7th graders building a parachute design. It's got to fall from 30 feet and land within a target zone. You know, we'll do that for, we'll work on that for about a week. They'll have to set up variables and test variables and know within a certain amount of air where this thing's going to land and be able to tell me before they actually do the final drop. And they're graded on that based on their prediction and how close they come to the actual. But then what I'll do is in the third week of that design challenge, I'll say, okay, we're done. You guys did a great job. Now we're going to drop the parachute from the same spot, but it's got to land off and to the right. So you need to modify the design that you have to make it fall, but fall to the right. And so now they got to think outside the box on how to do that. There's no manual for it, and I don't have a manual for it. They got to figure it out, and they got to figure it out by doing. They got to figure it out by adjusting and doing modifications. They have to just think and go do. And I love that kind of teaching for me because it lets me just step back and stop teaching and actually learn from the kids and watch how five different groups come up with a successful parachute, but it doesn't look anything like the other group. It's kind of the shuttle versus Soyuz. You know, they both get the job done, but they look different, and they're different sizes, and they have different, you know, levels of complexity. You know, I love that because it lets every group be proud of the fact that they can get their goal accomplished with the resources they have, simple or complex, but at the end of the day, they can share the same basic principles because it's still flight and it's dynamics and it's air and it's objects moving in gravity. So,
well, from not everybody can have Matt Allner as their teacher in their school district. So from a national perspective, is the country moving forward in achieving a better and more widespread STEM educational base? Are we still, you know, bucking up against the wall? And in terms of national policies, are we making progress? Like, what percentage of classroom teachers even know that there's a NASA grant available to help them do something like what you're doing, let alone how many apply for it and get it?
Yeah, well, you asked a couple of questions there that are really great again, and these are really fun topics to talk about. First of all, NASA isn't, at least to my knowledge today, they haven't had an open application for, like, middle schools, for instance, to apply to be in the Explore School program for a couple of years now. You know, they ran out of funding, and the funding that they were still, you know, the small amount they were given because of NASA cuts and whatnot, they were just using that to sustain the 300 schools that initially got in the program. I think for 6 years they brought in 50 schools a year, so I think that's right around 300. And we're the only true NASA Explore school in the state of Colorado. We're the only one. What's interesting about that, though, is that some of the schools I've, you know, worked with and the Explore schools, they've lost a lot of administrative support from the superintendent and from the principal for their programs because the school scores on the state test aren't high. And
Jesus.
Because they're not high and because this program isn't helping improve them, their view is that it's not a waste of time, but it's not helping us accomplish our primary goal, which is getting our scores up. And, you know, as we all know, you remove something from a school that kids enjoy and they're motivated to get involved in, you're dangerously removing something that may be like a sport to a student that's cooperating and doing well during the basketball season. You remove the sport from that child, and it's not even available to them, and their willingness and motivation to work hard to be eligible to play is diminished. Now, you know, I was an athlete, and that was never my primary focus was to get grades to play sports. my parents' standards at home were 10 times harder than our school and coaches ever could have given us, so those are easy standards for us to follow. But, you know, getting back into, you know, STEM, We really have to just be careful of removing programs that kids enjoy and want to be involved in. Again, it goes back to that piece of what are kids' needs. Kids need to feel like they're a part of something, whether it's a team or an organization. They need to feel like they're important. And, you know, we wonder why so many kids are turning to gangs and things. Gangs are a family. I mean, it's, you know, it may be different for you and I to understand, but there's love there and there's respect. Now, it may not be the respect we have in our lives, but it's still a different form of it. And they feel good about what they're doing and people acknowledge them in some way, shape, or form. And if they're not getting that from home with loving parents, or they're not getting it at school by being involved in something, then something's really missing. And kids are going to turn to something eventually. And so having, I think, programs like this is so important. You know, one of the other pieces to that answer, you mentioned and talked about, you know, is all this effort of STEM, is it making a difference? And that is the number one question. And that, I think, you know, I've talked to NASA about that a little bit, and I've asked them, you know, they do lots of surveys and things. But longitudinally, you have to show Congress that this is, you know, it's making a difference. It's improving something. So the question is what is it that we want it to improve? Obviously, we want more young people to be engaged in STEM, to pursue these kind of careers. Schools want test scores up. There's kind of a balance between what different entities want and the government putting these programs out into the schools and the schools taking them on and bringing them in. But I think the biggest thing is if you're going to collect surveys and data, people need to analyze it properly. And what I see, and thank God I had a research experience from grad school, I see a lot of very poorly analyzed data. I see people taking data and analyzing it one way and saying this is the answer and this is why things aren't happening. But in reality, we all know you can take that same data and you can twist it 5, 6, 10 different ways. I mean, you can manipulate, you know, that data to show what you want it to show to a point. And as a classic example, just last week, you know, I was kind of put on the spot and asked, you know, is our NASA program really impacting our students? You know, our science scores aren't going up, our math scores are going down. Is this program really helping? And my answer to that question was, not every student in the school is involved in the NASA program at the school. Yeah, we have the banner outside, and yeah, we say we're a NASA Explore school, but in reality, how many students in the school are really involved in the program, and how are those kids doing? Well, you start looking at those kids, and your numbers of kids that are doing well on the test are like in the 60-70 percentile, and they're outscoring their peers on all the district assessments by 20-30%. So to me, again, if you look at the data the right way, it shows that the kids who are involved, it is impacting them. Is it impacting all of them in a positive way? Not quite, but again, it's not fast food. You know, education takes time, and some kids are slower learners, and the light bulb comes on later, but you don't want to remove something that could catch them at some point, and the light comes on, and now they're understanding, they're tuned in, they're engaged, and they understand this big picture, and they have a ball rolling to keep moving on. So
I like that term, it's not fast food.
Yeah,
that's
what education is turning into, unfortunately, I think. It's just we want results. We want every kid to, you know, advance a grade level every year, and if they don't, then everyone's, you know, got to figure out what's wrong. And, you know, I tell you, my light bulb didn't come on until sixth grade. I had a teacher, Mrs. Rasmussen, I'll never forget her, and she did two magical things, and I'll never forget what they were, and it completely changed my belief in myself as a student. And the fact that, you know, I was always a good athlete, but I never believed I was a good student. I knew I was an average student. And she taught me to believe that I was an amazing student. And after her class, I had straight A's and B's all the way through school. So I think that the bulb comes on at different times for different kids. And for me, I was a little bit of a late bloomer, and I kind of bloomed again in college. And then I think even bloomed more in my graduate school work. But I'm just glad that the kind of programs that are coming into play now weren't in place when I was in school, because I think I would have been a very poor product of the direction that we're starting to head. So
let's do this question, and then we'll take a break because we skipped the first one. This is from John again in Montana. Is it NASA's mission to teach STEM, or is it to develop space technology, or is NASA looking for a broader mission in order to survive or alternatively to help rebuild a technological base in the next generation?
Wow, that's a big question. John, thanks for the question. I'll send you an email later. No, I was joking. That's a good one. I hope, you know, because NASA's direction could be changing very soon. I hope that NASA still stays involved in education. You know, I never remember NASA as being a big name when I was in school. You know, the most I remember about NASA when I was in school was Challenger, unfortunately. That was the big exposure that I remember having to NASA was around that mission. And then, of course, I remember watching it in school when the disaster happened. But NASA has, I think, done some great things. They're trying to manage a lot, maybe sometimes too much, but their heart's in the right place, and they're using something that is amazing. You know, sending a person into space is just a phenomenal thing. You know, you're getting into the Lewis and Clark stuff, and for me, that just sends chills down my spine. Just it's exciting. You know, it's the human nature to explore. And, I mean, who better can do that than NASA? Because, you know, Lewis and Clark in those days are done, but yet we have a new version, and that's space exploration. You know, what better way to captivate kids and people? You know, we all sit around campfires or in our backyards barbecuing in the evening, and we all glance up and look at, you know, what's that bright star, and it's really Jupiter, or we're looking at the moon, and it's looking kind of orange, and we're wondering what that is. You know, people are always curious about space, but they're just curious in different ways, and I think when you use NASA as a tool to inspire, I don't think you can think of a better entity to do that. I hope that they still stay in that game. It looks like, you know, according to the plan that's been rolled out from the Obama administration, that it's still there, but what it will look like, we don't know. But I really hope that if what I've heard about, you know, more money being put into education, you know, as long as it's not a carrot hanging out for everybody, you got to do this, this, and this to get all your money all the time. Money being put into education is really, it continued to be put into STEM and really keep the activities out there for kids to stay involved in, because I see them making a difference.
But specifically, you don't really know then whether, you know, what NASA hopes to get out of this. Does it hope to get these people to come work for NASA? Does it really look for helping the nation? Or is it more, you know, local to a NASA goal or purpose, similar to what John is saying? Have you ever seen a document or talk to NASA officials that say why they do this?
Well, I mean, obviously they want, you know, there's a need, and there's a need now, but there's going to be more of a need, you know, as the boomers are retiring. You know, as well as I do, a lot of the workforce in STEM is kind of holding out, you know, waiting for this, you know, the pipeline, as they refer to it, the students coming into the field. You know, I've heard two different things, and of course I'm not working in to really know the facts, but I've heard that there's not enough people, and I've heard that there is, and then I've heard there is enough people, but they're not quality. So whatever answer is really going on as far as what the pipeline looks like, you know, we want to be able to pull from the best and brightest. So you want your pipeline to be full of people and full of the brightest people, so that when you do pick, you get your best. You get your best working in those areas, because obviously there's national security interests and things that are involved and having STEM in place. But, you know, NASA, I don't think their number one goal, and this is just from having talked to lots of different people, not from, you know, Charlie Bolden, the administrator himself, but the number one goal of NASA is not to turn someone to STEM to work for NASA. It's to get them involved in STEM and work in a STEM career, because whether you're working governmental or private, it's still going to service the society. It's going to still service our government structure and our nation, and we need those jobs. We need people working in those fields. But if, you know, for instance, if all of our kids that are analytical are going into the video gaming industry, that's not going to help us with our needs down the road. And so there needs to be a fine balance between captivating those, you know, very analytical students and getting them to be interested in these fields, but also understand how it's going to contribute back to society. And that's a tough sale to a middle school or high school student. You know, they want to do stuff that's fun. They want to make a lot of money. They want to retire when they're 55 or 50. You know, they have a kind of a false reality of what they're looking for. But, you know, we got to kind of quit feeding it to them, too, that this is how you can, you know, get these things and push them in the right push them in the right directions, but push them in the right directions the right ways.
Well, I'll tell you, they're going to be paying interest on the deficit until they're 80 or 90, so this early idea of retirement. they better take some economic courses quick and get a dose of the reality of what's up for them for their future. Matt, hold on. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, let's continue talking about NASA. I want to know what it was like to apply to be an astronaut. You went down, you did interviews, I think you did some tests, and you went through the process, and it probably wouldn't matter if you made it or not, because if we have no missions for astronauts to fly, what would you do as an astronaut? That I doubt that came up when you were down there. But let's talk astronaut when we get back. So everybody stay where you are, back in 2 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. I'm your host of The Space Show, David Livingston. We're talking to Matt Allner. Okay, Matt, you applied and were told, come on down, bring your pink slip, and let's see if you're an astronaut in the making, right? And what did you have to go through? What is the process like?
Well, it's quite an experience. For people that have gone through it and either gotten in or not gotten in, they know how tough it is to make it through the initial cuts and to get to the point where you get an interview. I've applied twice. I applied back in 2003. Actually, it was kind of an interesting year when I did the first application because I was in the middle of just starting to fill out the application when Columbia disaster took place. And so that was a real reality check, and had to kind of step back a little bit, take a few weeks off of the application and just make sure that my wife and I and our family, that we had young kids at the time. They weren't obviously able to give any input to the decision, but, we had to really move forward and make sure this is what we were comfortable in wanting to do. It's okay for me to have my dreams, but they also involve right now for other people in the family. So, that was interesting, but I did go through it, and first time I ever applied, and I hadn't done anything with NASA. I'd never met anybody there. They didn't know me. And I think I made it down to like the final 300 applicants, and was kind of surprised and didn't know what was going to happen. But I didn't get a final call for an interview, but was invited down to Houston a few months after the final selection was made that first time. Got a chance to meet some people. I must have made an impression on a few astronauts because they pulled me aside at one point down in Houston and started kind of helping me with my resume. And I went home, and that's when I started grad school right away, and started learning some Russian, got my scuba certification, and things kind of took off from there. Reapplied again in 2008 when they just opened this last application, and moved through the same cuts that I'd moved through before, and then the long wait for the interview came, and you wait, and you kind of know roughly when the last month or weeks are where they're going to make calls for those final interviews. And I was like in the second to last week, so it was a little stressful getting down to the end. but I got the call for my interview. I was in the middle of teaching a class, had a whole room full of eighth graders, and I told them that, you know, guys, if I get a phone call from Houston, I will answer my phone because we have a rule. There's no using cell phones during class. So the call came through, and had the 281 from Houston area code number on it, and I told the kids to be real quiet, and they were listening, and I picked up the phone, and, you know, they introduced themselves and said, you know, this is, I think it was Teresa Gomez from the astronaut selection office, and we just wanted to know, is this a good time to talk, or are you busy? And, of course, you know, I was in the middle of teaching a lesson. I'm like, oh, no, I'm not busy at all. You know, the kids all kind of laughed, and, you know, it was pretty funny. So I had a whole class of eighth graders that got to be a part of that call, and it was a real emotional and special time to have gotten that call, and I think it was a perfect place to have it. The only other place I could have thought it would have been perfect to have would be at home with my family there, but it was a neat thing to share with them. So I got the call, they told me they had a couple of weeks that were left and asked me if there was one that worked better because I knew I was a teacher. And so I picked my week and had three more weeks to kind of train and keep working out to get ready. And then I went down to Houston.
So what happened when you went down to Houston? What do they do with you?
What do they do to me? No.
Yeah.
No.
Is it like the right stuff? Did you have to go through all of those invasive tests?
Well, I think that might have been more for the people that that made it to the second interview. From what I was told, anyway, that this was a little bit different selection process. In the previous years, again, this is what I've been told. In the previous years, there was one interview, and then you were selected from it or you weren't. This time around, they did two interviews. They did I think there was 110 finalists that were interviewed. From the original pool of, I think, 4,000 of the applicants that were considered highly qualified. And then they narrowed that down to like a final 40. And then they selected the 9 that were picked from that. So we went down in the first interview and they broke it up. They didn't do all the extensive medical that they did in the years past on the first interview. They did that on the second one. So most of my week was pretty comfortable. I mean, it was a lot of fun. It was enjoyable. It was interesting. It was neat. It was kind of like, wow, you get done with certain things. You'd be like, that was interesting, you know? So, sometimes you were kind of wondering what they were looking for by certain things they were doing, but, you know, they obviously have their reasons why they're doing the things they're doing. But the 4 days we were down there was just great. You know, I had a wonderful interview group. We had so much fun. We had this wonderful camaraderie. Our willingness to really help each other excel and do well for our interview week and helping each other do well really stood out, I thought, within our group that, you know, we did things very unselfishly. And, you know, we were fortunate one person from our group got through. His name is Jack Fisher. And couldn't have thought of a better person. Of course, anyone in the group getting in would have been the same, but couldn't have asked for a nicer guy from our group to get in. And, you know, we're all real proud and real happy for him. Your week down there, they do a great job, you know, making you feel at home, making you feel comfortable. You know, obviously they want to get to know you and not who you might be pretending to be. But I think everybody down there was just being themselves from what I experienced. And, hopefully, that's what they were able to showcase while they were there. But, yeah, they give you quite a few assessments. We did a psych assessment when we were there. They give you you did a robotics assessment. They do some anthropometric measurements to, you know, see if you'd fit in the Soyuz. That was kind of interesting. They put us in the seat profile for the Soyuz seat, and I'm pretty small. I'm about 5'9", maybe 5'10" on a good day, and I'm about 175, 180 pounds, and I was pretty squeezed in that little seat they had to sit in. I thought to myself, my God, thank God. No wonder why they want small astronauts. But it was pretty neat going through the assessments. We got to do a workout one morning with a few of the astronauts, and they kind of took us through a military kind of a PT test where we worked in groups, and the encouragement of teamwork and working within your team was there, and it was also a lot of fun. So I think probably the most enjoyable part of the week, though, was the actual interview itself, where we were each given an opportunity to come in at a scheduled time and sit down with the selection committee, which I think was comprised of about 14 people, astronauts, some NASA personnel, and we had about an hour to, you know, tell them our story about who we were and what we're all about and answer a few of their questions. And That was a neat, really neat experience, and I'll probably remember that part of the whole week more than anything in years to come. So,
what should you have answered to have gotten accepted?
Well, you know, I don't know that there's A1 answer that you can give. I mean, there's a lot of things. You know, I've been in part of helping select divers for our dive team, and there's all sorts of things that, you know, a group will look for, and it can change every time. You know, obviously, I think one of the most important things is that you want to know that you're going to enjoy being around and working with this person if they get hired. And, you know, most people, I think, they're highly intelligent, can learn most anything if they're trained and trained well enough. You know, they can learn things. They can be taught to do things. And, you know, obviously, you know, intelligence is part of, you know, getting selected. But I think compatibility and personality and just, you know, the people who are there right now, would they enjoy working with you? That's a big thing. But as far as answers, you know, I spoke with a lot of astronauts that I live in Colorado Springs, and there's a lot of astronauts here, and just inadvertently I've run into quite a few off and on in different places, and, you know, we get into conversation, and I'll let them know, you know, hey, it's neat to think, God, you've been in space 4 times, and I really envy you. You know, I've gone through this application process twice, and I didn't get selected from my interview I had, and one of the guys was like, you had an interview already? And I said, well, yeah, I had one last January. And he said, I applied 4 times before I even got to, like, the second cut. And, you know, he flew in space, I think, 3 or 4 times. And so he said, just keep applying and just keep doing the things you're doing. You never know why or how they're going to select you, but you just, you know, just stay persistent. And so I've had a lot of good encouragement from people that it's a process. It's a process to get in, and sometimes you don't get in right away, and sometimes you have to wait. So,
Larry in Boston says, how long does the training take, and do you move your family to Houston? What is the protocol if you get accepted into the training? I'm assuming it's not final until you graduate as an astronaut.
Yeah, you know, my family's asked me that same question. Different people have different perceptions, and of course mine was different until I got down and learned a little bit more and had been around a few astronauts. But you know, the norm, I guess, is that you get selected and you're not an astronaut right away. You're an astronaut candidate, and you report to Houston at a given date, and you relocate. I suppose you don't probably have to, but you know, anybody that has a family obviously would want to relocate because you're going to be down there permanently. That'll be your permanent home base. So you move your family to Houston, you report to duty, and you start your training, and trainings, classes, it's all sorts of things. I think you can get onto the NASA websites and just Google astronaut candidate school or astronaut candidate program, and it kind of takes you through an overview of what the astronauts have to learn to officially become part of the Corps, so to speak. So they're candidates until they're done with their schooling, which can take, I think, anywhere on an order of a year, 2.5 years, maybe 2 years, depending on the training program they're going through. And then at that point, once they've kind of graduated from candidate school, then they're able to be assigned to a mission. But until they're assigned, they keep doing different types of training, and they have a job, and they do their job until their assignment comes up for a mission that they're going to train for. So that's kind of the general scope, I believe, of what happens when you get selected.
What's the chances of actually getting on a mission and flying in space? How many astronauts are there versus how many missions, and how many people get repeat missions?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know that I really can answer that. That's probably more of a question for an astronaut or someone in the office that, you know, works with the mission assignments and things. You know, every year the number of missions that take place vary. You know, we have shuttle missions that are still being completed, and then we have also you know, some of our astronauts that train for long duration space flight, and a lot of them you know, go to Russia and they do their training there, and they go up in the Soyuz. So it's going to vary a little bit. I think, if I remember correctly, when I was down there last January, there was, like, I want to say 80 some astronauts that were, I think, active. But in those 80, some of them were not eligible to fly. They were working in management positions. I may be off on my facts there, but it was somewhere in the order of about 80 astronauts that were down in the office working. So But, you know, every time a shuttle goes up, you take six or seven and maybe exchange one out on the station and bring one back. And so you usually get about one, you know, one American per shot. So.
Well, of course, that's going to be a lot less when shuttle goes and the only human spaceflight is one or two seats on a Soyuz a couple of times a year.
Mm-hmm.
So the astronauts aren't going to, you know, have a lot of flying opportunities, I would imagine.
Yeah, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with that. I think that's the big question with human spaceflight right now is if these changes do roll out the way that they've been elicited on this NASA fact sheet, you know, the commercial entity is going to take, you know, a lot bigger scope, and how exactly that'll develop and what it will look like. You know, I mean, it says in here, you know, I'm reading it right off the web, off the document, you know, directs NASA to partner with the aerospace industry in a fundamentally new way, making commercially provided services the primary mode of astronaut transportation to the space station. You know, that's going to be a big one. And, you know, I don't know personally how the astronauts feel. If I remember on one of your shows, you'd asked me, would I ever be interested in, you know, flying with a private company? And I kind of joked and said, well, what's their track record, you know? I think that's going to be, you know, that's going to be a determining factor for some people, is that, you know, right now getting into the astronaut corps, you know, you kind of know what you're up against, you know, the statistics, you know, the success and failure rates and those ratios, you know, they play in your favor if you're, you know, if you have a family and you have, you know, things that you're, you know, really thinking about that are safety related. When you start over fresh from scratch with a new company or a new entity, you know, a lot of that's, you know, potentially going to change, and how much involvement NASA is going to have in developing human rated spacecraft and whatnot. I think that'll be interesting too, to see what their involvement is going to be in that, and how much the astronauts will want to have a say in, you know, being involved in that safety aspect. So, some interesting things are definitely coming down the pipe, that's for sure.
Harry in Tucson, I'm going to go ahead and read it, sent in a comment and said, I bet the astronaut corps can't wait to transition over to the private sector and do suborbital flights with Virgin and X-Corps. I'm sure that'll be really relevant for them to get their astronaut wings. Do you want to comment on Harry's comment?
No, I think his comment is probably best directed at an astronaut, so I'll pass on that one. Interesting question, Harry.
Yeah, well, or a comment, Harry, and it sounds like you're a little tongue-in-cheek, Harry. Get with the program, what can I say? Marshall in Dallas, Texas, is changing the topic of our discussion on us.
Okay.
So in your bio that I have up on the newsletter, I have the information you supplied to me about the book, Human Performance in Extreme Environments, okay?
Yes.
And it says it's going to be published in the fall of 2009. So Marshall says, Valery Polyakov spent 438 consecutive days on Soyuz TM-18. One of the problems identified on the mission was space detachment. He lost his mental references to Earth. Hell, half the people I know have lost their mental references to Earth. They don't even have to go to space for that. His total world became the space station. Towards the end, he was not responding to his ground controllers. Do any of the extreme environments that you know about properly train people to handle space detachment?
Wow. That's a good question. I tell you, I'll answer this question only from the perspective of my diving and some of my high altitude experience. I won't for one second even go into the space application on that, because that's more for, I think, a veteran retired astronaut to answer. I would say in my experiences diving, we weren't, I mean, we dove when I was a rescue diver, and I say when because I'm not actively a rescue diver anymore. When I was a rescue diver for 3 years in Iowa, we dove the Missouri River. And, of course, the running joke in Iowa is, you know, what kind of things do you say, cows or pigs, you know. We actually dove in some pretty serious stuff. The water we dove in, the Missouri River, one of the fastest moving waterways in North America. And it's, you know, depending on what part of the Missouri you're in, and we were, you know, in Iowa, it's completely blackout because it's so muddy. And so when we dove, we had a backup diver, but they were on the boat, and we were the primary diver. If you were the primary diver, you were the one that went down, so your backup was on the boat. You weren't really in the water with a buddy where you had that comfort level that you used to have when you do basic scuba. So the stakes were a little higher, and the reality of where we dove is that, and we were trained to think this way, is that if something happens to you, if you can't get yourself out of it, your buddy's not going to probably come down and get you out of it. It's probably going to shift from a rescue to a recovery. And understanding the two definitions of those words really hits you hard when you join the team. And so one of the things that we did to train, because we were in essence in isolation, but it was for a shorter period of time, was to control breathing, to use your calm, to communicate, because we were able to talk to, you know, a person up on the boat, not several people, but a person. And you know, I think you learn to use your mission control, so to speak, as a tool, and not feeling alone and isolated, and just kind of having that comfort level of having someone near you. I can't specifically speak for Valeri and what he went through, but that'd be a long period of time to be isolated completely on your own, and I suppose over time you probably would get less and less wanting, perhaps, to have conversations with you know, mission control, because they're just not there. And that was something that we saw in the diving, where they're up in the boat and they're comfortable, they're in the sun or whatever, but they're safe, and you're down here in this environment that's so dangerous. And sometimes you didn't want people talking to you, sometimes you did. And what we learned to do is to put the right people on comm for the person who was diving. And every diver had kind of two people they wanted talking to them, and nobody else. And it wasn't a personal thing, it just was the preference. And you know, again, I'm assuming that astronauts kind of feel the same way. And so I think the transition of mission control and that importance of having that voice in the comm and having the right voice is an important thing, and it still will be as we move down the road in the future.
When I was younger and thinner and I was doing sport diving for underwater photography and diving articles for warm water oceans all over the place, and I was traveling all over the world, I took a course in Long Beach at the Commercial Divers Center or whatever it was called, CDC or something like that. It's been a long, long time. And, you know, we got into the old Navy dive suits and the hard hats, and, you know, we had pipe wrenches that we had to, you know, learn to use that were my size, 60 feet down on the bottom of the Long Beach Harbor in water that you can't see crap in front of. But you know what, we could shine a light and see a fitting that we had to learn to take apart and do this and do that. And, you know, I did a 3-day course and I could do everything but mixed diving. But we had calm. And, we were down there alone and we were not with a buddy. There was nobody supervising us, and everything that they could monitor from us was through the comm and, of course, the compressors pumping air into us in the suits that we were wearing, you know, the old big Navy, what was it, Mark 5 or Mark 7, with a one-way valve in it. And that voice on the comm that talked to us made all the difference in the world, from getting claustrophobic in the suit, freaking out, being able to work the huge wrenches, and trust me, they were really huge. I mean, you would not want to be lifting these things up on the surface or on the ground. Depending on who was talking to us and how that worked, it was a pretty amazing, you know, experience, and it could be a disaster, or we could be talked and guided and be really calm and efficient in our air use and everything. And then the other story I have to tell about that, one of my listeners is also a frequent guest on the show, David Hook, and he flew C-130s on dark missions into Germany way back when. And they had a Voice of America voice that guided these Air Force pilots in, none other, and I guess it's no secret because I've talked to Rhonda about it on air, was Rhonda Milliron of Inner Orbital. And these pilots looked for Rhonda and her voice as they were flying those secret missions in. And it was her voice on the comm that took them in and greatly facilitated their comfort level to do their Air Force missions coming into Germany. And so when you talk about who's on the comm with you in those kind of situations, that's really, really huge. Now, obviously, going into space, you're up there for months and months like he was, is totally different than a flying mission or a diving thing where you're down there for a limited amount of time and then you're coming right back up. But, you know, that voice that is guiding you and is your safety valve is really, really important and has to be matched to, you know, your ability to communicate and facilitate with that person.
Right. And I think every person that's in that extreme environment, having the person in the mission control on the other line, every person's preference is going to be different. For me, I wanted a diver from my team that had dove the river talking to me on the comms.
That knew what they were doing, that knew what you were encountering.
That knew the environment.
Yeah.
Someone that had been there. Because for me, and this is just, again, this is my preference, for me, I highly respect people that have done things I've done when they're trying to give me advice. But I also respect people that give me advice that haven't been there, but you understand the difference.
Oh, absolutely.
Credibility and your willingness to trust them and not kind of blow them off, so to speak. And you just don't want that kind of communication going on where you're getting advice and you're just trying to tune it out to focus in an environment where there's a lot of stress. You want someone who knows, hey, you know, I know where he's at. I've dove this part of the river. Just, he needs to be left alone for a minute, or he needs a joke right now. I'm going to say something funny. You just kind of know that. And all the divers, we understood that. We just knew how to talk to each other. We never could stress each other out on comm. And, you know, we were very specific where we went down. Hey, you know, don't talk to me too much today. Or, hey, tell me a couple jokes when I'm down. Or you could kind of tell by their personality before they went in the water what they were going to need or what they were going to want when they were down. And so you just, you know, you got to pay attention to people and sometimes ask them questions. But, you know, also just focus in on their tone, their body language, and all those other things and just, you know, read each other a little bit. So
did you ever, human performance in extreme environments get published?
The book actually has not been published yet. It was originally, and I'm sorry I didn't update that in my bio. It was anticipated it would be published in the fall, but there was a postponement due to some things that came up, and so it's been delayed a little bit. And I'm actually still in the process of revising my chapter. They were able to send a few changes that I have to my chapter, but it's a real exciting chapter that I'm writing for the book. It's called "It's All in Search and Rescue." And it talks about the different environments of search and rescue around the world. Even though my specialty is water, the gentleman that are co-authoring with me, Dr. Ragalov, he's helping me with mountain and water rescue because he's had experience in Russia with that. Good friend of mine who was my mountaineer guide here in Colorado Springs, Jamie Pierce, he's amazing. I mean, he's got world certifications. The guy's he's done about everything. And he's coming on the mountain and the cold environment aspect. And then I have Dr. Chris McKay from NASA Ames. And Chris has been...
We all know who he is, too. He's been on the show.
He's been to every extreme environment on the planet. And if someday we can get him to Mars, I'm sure he'll go there, too.
Who's publishing the book? Is it your book, or is there an editor to the book? Or who is actually publishing it?
The book actually has three primary authors. There's several. Every chapter is being written by a different author. The main editor is Jason Crane and Peter Sudfeld and oh my gosh, it's terrible. I should have had all these names written down. But Jason, Peter, and I'm trying to think of the other gentleman's name. Bartlett. I don't know Jason and the other co-author very well, but Peter Sudfeld is a researcher from University of British Columbia, and Peter and I have done journal research together, paper research together. So he was the one that originally invited me to join in.
Well, when it gets published, let me know. Let's do a program about it and talk about it on air. It sounds like a lot of really fascinating topics that we should air on the Space Show.
Yeah, the chapters in the book are pretty exciting. There's a chapter in there about space. It's being written by Sunita Williams and I'm trying to think of some of the other. I don't have the document right in front of me here, but there's some great authors and some amazing chapters. A lot of military search and rescue stuff, fire search and rescue. It'll be pretty neat.
Well, keep me posted on that, and I'll depend on you to tell me when it's going to be available and how we can put a show together on it, okay?
Sure.
Okay, another UND student who's going to graduate coming up, Alan Kreider, who you may know, a former student of mine as well, said, what do you think about the commercial aspects of training new space astronauts? How can training curricula be both down to the average person or K through 12?
Again, is this question more, you know, how do you develop curriculum, or is it more how would you train a college student to get into being a commercial astronaut?
All right, I cannot psych out Alan. Let's see, he just sent in another one. Maybe he's clarifying it.
Okay.
No, he's really not. What do you think or do you foresee computer systems fulfilling the role of mission control type support like HAL in 2001? Okay, Alan, here's the deal. We don't really quite get the gist of your first question, so pick up the phone and dial 1-866-687-7223 and talk to us, my friend. So is HAL 2001 going to take over mission control?
Well, I don't know a whole lot about HAL 2001, but all I know is with any kind of mission control, I think you want to really, I mean, there's been a lot of research done on the psychological component of helping astronauts feel calm and feel relaxed, and feel appreciated or valued or whatever the issue might be. You know, you go back to the Skylab issue that took place and the workload. I love that scenario and story. I remember reading about it in grad school, and that one story really helped me with how I integrated my research into our dive team, because we had those kind of problems where we were putting our divers under lots of stress, not realizing it. You know, we're just wanting to get our job done, and so to speak. And you know, that was something that we really talked about. I even brought it up. I said, you know, here's a scenario happened with NASA, and look at how these astronauts handled it. I said, you know, if you stress a diver out underwater and you don't stop, they're just going to unplug the comm. they're in charge. You know, you're just giving them advice and friendly support, but you've told them the job. They're down there. If you're bugging them to a point where they feel like it's distracting them and they're getting stressed, they're just going to unplug you. And, you know, we all laughed about it as divers, but in reality, we all knew we'd do that if we had to, just to cut that, you know, channel out. So I don't know about having automated mission controls and having, you know, computers talking to people and all these kind of things. I don't know exactly, like I said, I don't know a whole lot about the HAL program, but I just know that I would want a human on the other side. I wouldn't want an automated system talking to me. I have enough of a problem with that when I try to call the bank and I got all these automated systems reading my responses. So I'd rather have a human. I like talking to people. It's more personable, but that's just my preference.
This is Leonard, and Leonard is in Colorado Springs, and he said, assuming the administration's version of space policy is enacted, do you think you will have a harder time, the same time, or it's not relevant as a time in inspiring and motivating kids about space when there is such a delay in establishing human spaceflight again by the United States?
Good question, real good question. I've actually had to ask myself that question in the last week. Just
right, because it's current,
yeah. Yeah, how's it going to change? You know, I don't think we're abandoning, you know, space exploration. We're just, you know, this plan that's being laid out, from what I can see, is just changing it. You know, it's recognizing the fact that, I shouldn't say the fact, but it's recognizing that according to the Augustine Committee report, we don't have enough money to fund what we're trying to do right now, and if that's the case, it's only going to get more expensive in years to come, and it's going to require more money. And if we don't foresee we're going to have it, then I guess the point of this change is that why are we doing it? Now, I'm not saying that, but that's according to what I'm reading in these reports. You know, it also talks about game changers, you know, game changing technology, and I know Administrator Bolden talked about it when we were over in Korea for the IAC. You know, I was in a group of about 10 NASA-sponsored students that went to South Korea to present research, and we had an hour with the administrator, and what an amazing man. Boy, I tell you, he if people haven't had a chance to meet him, it's a real treat and honor to meet him. He's very, very passionate about education. He's got grandchildren in school and very passionate about NASA, obviously, with his astronaut background and whatnot. But he really talked about the game-changing technologies. And, you know, I'm coming from the psychology background and experience with my research. And one of the two biggest problems I foresee going to Mars that, to me, doesn't make it much of a reality until we really fix it is, one, you know, radiation exposure. You know, your duration of time traveling there exposes you. And then however long your mission is and then your return, I mean, what is the likelihood that you won't be doused with a lifetime dose of radiation? And, you know, it's serious stuff. Then you got the psychological component and then all the group dynamic stuff, which is where, you know, my research is tied into. And, you know, the longer you stay away, the more potential problems you could have in those areas. And, you know, how are the social dynamics of the crew going to change? You know, the one question I always have, I think is funny because I've seen it on teams I played sports with. I've seen it in schools where I worked. I've seen it on the dive team is just because you have a leader doesn't mean that they're going to be the leader when something moves on or something takes place, a space mission or whatever. Will the leadership switch? Even though you do have a leader and a commander, will the dynamic structure be strong enough when the group takes off that it'll still be the same when it comes back? And, you know, the concepts of groupthink, the concepts of you know, mutiny, whatever you want to call it, you know, those leadership roles, they can get reestablished very quickly by a group, even though, for instance, you know, if my head coach says, you know, I'm the quarterback and I'm the captain in charge, doesn't still mean I'm calling the shots, even though it may look that way. So, you know, having that understanding and background of this duration, the time going to Mars, so many of those things can come up, and they could be things that are completely out of control where mission control could help, and having that insight and understanding. So a game-changing technology like a propulsion system that could get us there in, say, 2, maybe 3 months as opposed to 6 to 9, it eliminates a lot of the radiation risk, and it eliminates a lot of the psychological component that, you know, those two things go hand in hand with duration of time that you're exposed in space. So it'll be interesting, but I do believe we need a game-changing technology, a propulsion system. But then if we're going to get there faster, can our bodies survive it physiologically? There's the other question, too. So a lot of questions.
We've got a caller on hold, but first I'm going to ask you this question, which I'm now asking every single guest who addresses the new space policy administration program or the program of record. And that question is, I actually asked it to you before we started the show, what do you see as the impact of the U.S. and global economic situations and specifically our growing deficits, which are, you know, by everybody's account, out of control and getting more and more out of control? Do you see economic issues thwarting any space development program, whether it's program of record or the new one, or will somehow economic issues not be factored in on whatever our space policy is to become?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not the president, and I don't, you know, look at the budget that he's looking at every day. You know, I think the best way to answer that question, one, when I look at what's being laid out for NASA, they're not taking a cut. They're actually going to get an increase in budget. You know, where you put your money as a person, as a country, doesn't matter. It says where your priorities are. And, you know, if people that really believe in space believe in it, they're going to have to convince Congress and convince our president or whoever that's going to be even down the road. They're going to have to keep convincing them that this is important. They're going to have to explain to them why. It's no different than how I have to explain day to day to a parent that, you know, a student behaving in class is important, not just for them, but for everyone else in class it's affecting. You know, exploration has been part of our country and its existence since we started. And, you know, I began my research on Lewis and Clark and Thomas Jefferson, and the more I learned about that, the more I was just so impressed with what a true visionary Thomas Jefferson was. And, you know, even the psychologists, you know, credited him as being a self-actualizer, and that's like the top 10% of the world population can even achieve that status. But he was such a future thinker and could think so far out down the road and outside the box on things. You know, that's something that's not easy for everyone to do. And then the question becomes, is of the people who are in leadership positions making decisions, are they self-actualizers? Are they really 10, 15, 20 year down the road thinkers, and do they know where we're going to be? And nobody really knows, but some people do, and they're very savvy at it. Knowing where we're going to, you know, where we're going to be with budgets and deficits and things down the road, that's not, you know, I'm not really one of those people, but I just hope we don't turn our back on exploration, on Earth and in space, because they define, you know, what is best about humans, and I think humans exploring and making those discoveries is so important. And I've had this discussion with people about the robotics versus human side. I think both of them are important and they complement each other, but I think what inspires people is people finding new things and not robots finding new things. And if a human can do it alongside of a robot and have assistance, then both sides of that picture win. But I just don't see, you know, millions of Americans getting on board and supporting the space program that doesn't have people out there, you know, doing those great things and serving in those kind of hero roles. I think that's what motivates and inspires us and gets us to believe in these great things that we're trying to do. So,
let's see who our caller is. Caller, are you still with us, please?
Yes, David. Alan Kreider here.
Hey, are you on speakerphone?
No, I'm on my headset.
Okay, well, because it's echoing back a little bit.
Okay, well, I'll change out. Is better?
Yeah, that's better.
All right. Yes, my question was based on, I mean, there's a lot of Americans who have the dream of someday going to space, and they see that in the commercial market that the potential may be there for them to actually fulfill that dream. So, but many Americans, you know, take medications and have all kinds of issues that would disqualify them at some level for spaceflight. How do you see systems being brought down to for average Americans to be able to make it?
Okay, that's kind of what I just thought your question was earlier. You know, I'm not in all those planning stages to really be a highly credible person to answer the question, but I guess what, you know, I thought a little bit about those things. You know, we have space tourists, people that have gone over to Russia, have gone up on the Soyuz and gone into space and been safe and come back home. You know, I think, you know, space travel is dangerous, one, and two, you physically and physiologically and psychologically, you have to be up to it. And what, you know, defining that is not necessarily an easy thing. I mean, there's a lot of things that disqualify people medically. You know, I know that I've visited with people that have been disqualified medically through the NASA astronaut selection process, but they got back in and got an interview again. So some medical conditions aren't so severe that you're ruled out permanently, and there's no reason to apply again. Sometimes there are things that are just up at the moment, and they want to watch it maybe down the road. I think with commercial spaceflight, they're going to have to do the same thing. It's not like getting in an airplane and flying from Colorado Springs to Chicago. I mean, you know, your exposure to high G forces potentially can be even way beyond what, you know, you even train for. You know, there's going to be obviously risk involved with people doing it. Could it be more accessible to the average American that maybe not having to go through as strenuous of a selection process? I suppose yes. You know, it also can be more political, too. I mean, if you got more companies involved and more spaceships to go up in, you know, having money to go, knowing someone that can help you get involved to go, there's going to be all sorts of different dynamics, I think, that'll come into play as opposed to maybe just with NASA. You know, there's a specific criteria. I don't know how much wiggle room there is in the criteria because I'm not on the selection committees, but, you know, it's kind of what it is. And you got to be the best of the best to get in, and that's just the way it is. I don't know if it'll be that stringent, but again, how many of the NASA astronauts would potentially be displaced from NASA and put in these commercial entities to help, you know, be the pioneers to get the program up and going? Could they be the ones that train and select the next group of people coming in from, you know, from the public? You know, I don't know what that's going to look like. I don't even know if those discussions have really been on the table, so it'll be interesting to see.
I have a question.
I think many Americans have a view of space somewhat like Hollywood portrays. They think that it's easy, that it's not comparable to, say, climbing Mount Everest, which it really is.
I think a lot of space advocates have that view too, Alan.
Yeah, I think the answer to your question too also lies in, if a person's going to space, what are they going for? You know, are you just going for the sheer, you know, amusement park ride to say that you went and, you know, get out and talk and share your experience and write a book when you're done? Or are you going to really make an impact on space exploration and actually finding and doing something while you're there? You know, every astronaut that goes up to the space station has a variety of jobs they have to do. They don't just get to go into space and play with water and eat food and have a good old time. You know, they're there and they have a job to do. And I think, you know, space tourism wants to let people have the experience of space. But if we're going to go back and still colonize the moon and build a settlement and then move on to Mars, you got to be coming to the table with degrees and intelligence and something to offer the program, and not just be an innocent bystander, just go along for the ride taking pictures. You're going to have to work. You're going to have to understand a lot of things. And I think, you know, the average citizen, going back to your question, still, I think you're going to have to bring something to the table, not just a, you got trained quick for a month or two and, you know, you get to plop in a seat and go along. If things go bad, people are going to rely upon you. And I would think that if you're going to go, you'd want to have some experiences and some background that would lend yourself capable of helping, you know, with whatever goal or, you know, mission objective needed to be accomplished in the worst-case scenario. So, you know, if you think about it, if you're the highly trained person and you're just dragging a person along on a long-duration mission and something goes bad and you need them to do work, now you're having to babysit a person, making sure that they're not going to make a mistake and make things worse for you, as opposed to being able to give them a job and know they can accomplish it. So there's kind of, going to be a little bit of a fine line there. But again, I'm not the company that's hiring all those astronauts either.
Do you guys remember the old TV show? This is going to really date you if you remember it. Dobie Gillis, and they had the Beatnik. That tells you how old it is. Maynard G. Krebs. Who was what me work? He would never do any work for anyone. So he might be the long duration spaceflight tourist with money that goes up there. You'll have Maynard G. Krebs to deal with, who won't do any work for anything.
I haven't heard of it. Sorry.
God, I'm really dating myself with Dobie Gillis. I bet John, who's still listening to the show, knows who Dobie Gillis was. He's back from my age group. God, how horrible it is to, I can understand why they want to have death panels in national health care to get rid of us when we cite Dobie Gillis as a reference. Alan, what else?
Well, I caught the end of your Mars talk that you were going on, and it currently happens we're working on a capstone project, a mission to Mars, trying to figure out the most plausible way to go to return to Mars, or go to Mars rather, and return to the moon. But it's a difficult process with the current political process that's going on right now. Yes, I'll return to my snowstorm here in Colorado. So,
okay.
You guys have a nice evening.
Yeah, thanks for calling in.
Sure.
Matt, we're coming up toward, we're way beyond the typical end of the show. First of all, for people who want to follow up with you, do you give out an email address or should they go through me?
No, that's fine. I don't have a problem. My email is mmjallner, A-L-L-N-E-R, at msn.com. And if you have access, if you have a hard time accessing me, you can always contact Dr. Livingston.
Closing comments, anything you want to continue to talk about or say, or that we should have asked or discussed?
I think our topic, I really appreciate the topics that we had a chance to talk about today, and I hope people listening enjoyed it. There's a lot of disappointing things going on right now, and people would love to see things differently in the country, both in education and space, all sorts of things. You know, the only thing I can say to put some hope, words of encouragement in for people is just to continue to try to stay as positive as you can, even on days when it's hard. And you know, the number one theme I've been seeing is just we've all got to be willing to listen to each other and really sit down and be open-minded to suggestions on how to improve things and where to move things if we do need to move them in a new direction. And that's been the one thing I think I've seen through not only education but also through my international travels is that sometimes we struggle really being willing to listen. We kind of have our agendas and we already have the things in our mind that we want to do, and we just push them. We push them until we either get them or we don't. But I think our time is going to be defined by our willingness to really listen and learn how to truly collaborate, fairly collaborate with others, both within the country and abroad. And what that'll look like, I don't know. But those are the things I just see that are kind of holding things back a little bit. So just encourage everyone to continue to try to do those things.
Very well said. I think the listening is probably harder than the engineering that needs to be done. but we will see. Matt, stay in touch, and we'll look forward to the next time, okay?
Thanks again. Appreciate you having me on.
Well, no, thanks go to you. Excellent program and discussion. We really appreciate hearing from you, and I look forward to the next time as well. And listeners, that's it for today. So on behalf of Matt Allner and myself in the Space Show, thanks for tuning in and listening live as well as on archives. Monday, noted space attorney George Robinson's back with us. Read the newsletter when I publish it. Lots of fascinating topics to talk about. And then we have an added show Wednesday. Jim Muncy, who's one of the co-founders of the Space Frontier Foundation, is coming on to talk about the positives and the support of the administration space policy program. And Pascal Lee is back on Friday from the Mars Institute. Open lines on Sunday. And then, of course, Contact Conference, one of my favorite conferences, is the subject of the Tuesday night show with Jim Funaro again. So a really interesting, active week on the Space Show with an extra program with Jim Muncy, who is always an exceptional guest. And I might say, since we've had a somewhat of a UND program here today with John asking questions and Alan calling in and asking questions and our guest Matt graduating from the program and me teaching there as well, and Jim is in that first graduating class of students in space studies from UND. So, Matt, again, thanks a lot for being here, and you and I will stay in touch for sure.
Great. Thanks again for having me on.
Listeners, that's it for today. Goodbye, everyone. Have a great week.